Hi, hello, welcome. 欢迎大家 to another episode of Hot and Sour Soup for the Soul. Happy New Year. I hope all of your 2021s are going swimmingly or as close to swimmingly as possible. Befitting for the new year, today's episode is about intentionality and adaptability. Really entering into the new year with purpose and rolling with the punches come what may. As the saying goes, life is what happens when we're busy making other plans. Inevitably, there are times when things don't go according to plan. This past year has been a relentless testament to that. So what do we do when the inevitable happens? How do we survive, and if we're lucky, find opportunities to thrive during chaos? Today, we talk with Ruoyi Jiang, owner and director of Chop Suey Club, a contemporary Chinese design boutique nestled in New York City's Lower East Side that's redefining what made in China can mean, about how she creates magic when plans don't go according to plan. Once upon a time, Ruoyi was a middle schooler living in China who decided to drop out to pursue a professional golf career. Since then, she's moved to New York City, worked the Met Gala, and launched a concept store in the Lower East Side. Suffice to say, Ruoyi is a maestro of intentionality and adaptation. We chat with Ruoyi about the business dynamics of Chinatown, untangling appropriation and appreciation, and navigating life's yin and yang, all while growing the customer base of a brick and mortar in the midst of a pandemic. Stay tuned. Hey, Ruoyi. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Adrian.
I would like to share with the audience how Ruoyi and I met. I was messaging with an angel on Instagram because I wanted to pick up these glasses that I had seen before all the shops shut down. And luckily, they were still available on the Chop Suey Club site. We'll get into Chop Suey Club in a little bit. So I decided to reach out, and lo and behold, I made contact with the founder of Chop Suey Club, who then goes on to recommend different sunglasses for my face shape, things that match my vibe. And then she and I wound up meeting out at her storefront for the pickup, and we got to talking. It's a thrill to have you on the show and for you to kind of share your experience, how it's been running a local contemporary shop, brick and mortar in the time of a pandemic, amongst other things.
Yeah, sounds really good. I'm really excited to be on your show, and I'm really happy that we connected.
For those new listeners who are tuning in and unfamiliar with the general episode framework, we travel through the past, present, and future, zooming in on pivotal moments that have shaped you, our guest, into getting to where you are today, and how maybe your Asian identity has played a part in those moments. So we'll start with the past and have you share with us a little bit about your growing up in China. Ruoyi didn't come to the US until undergrad when she came to attend NYU in the late 2000s. So you spent like all your adolescence in China. How was that for you?
I had a somewhat, I would say maybe a little bit unusual path compared to a regular Chinese kid growing up. I think it was the second semester of ninth grade, I decided to drop out of school and play professional golf as a career because I just didn't really like the idea of having to take these massive exams. To, you know, we have this thing called 中考, so it's like a SAT kind of thing.
Except so your entire life rides on the 中考.
Yeah, exactly.
GPAs don't matter. It's a single test that determines your fate.
And there's also sports part, you know, kind of you have to run 800 meters and do these like have this physical requirements for you to get into a good high school. And once you get in a good high school, your goal is to get into a good college. And then after a good college, it just seems like there is nothing else really and nothing really to look forward to. The whole job market and just career outlook was really bleak. And boring looking, at least from my point of view at the time. So I really didn't know what we were doing there. The stuff we learned in school didn't feel like was so much use. So I thought I may well just start a more professional career and maybe use that as a way to get a scholarship into college. At least I'm like practicing a skill. So that was the thought. So I dropped out, and it was a really hard thing because once you drop out, you can't really go back in. So that was a lifetime decision. But I did, and I played for 2 years. During that time, I came to the States once, and I realized how late I was in terms of starting a professional sports career. I noticed the kids here started way younger, like when they're even 3 or 5. So yeah, I felt like, okay, this is not really like Marty on the disadvantage side. And also then I realized being a professional athlete is not what I thought it was going to be. It was just, of course, there was a lot of training, but there was really very, very, very little education, academic education, even though you're promised that. So that's when I transferred to a fairly new international school. They're called Beijing City International School. So they recruited me. It turned out that I was the only student there for 2 years. Yeah, I was a class of one. It wasn't my plan because I was originally told there will be 6 people, including me. Somehow when this school started, I was the only person there. So if you look at my graduation picture, I was the only one like in there among like
it's a portrait of
faculty. Yeah, it was really really funny, you know.
You're like the founding mother of the school. They should have a bust of you in the lobby.
Oh yeah, it was really, really bizarre. Like, you know, we have fire drills. Everybody has to be on the soccer field. Every class standing one line, and I was just like the only person in this line always, and you know, the whole school knows who I was.
And then a huge transition for you, right? From being the single student in your class to then coming to New York, attending NYU, where you were one of thousands of students.
Yeah. The reason I mentioned this in this international school was because I only later realized how much I've learned from being in that school, being with such a diverse cultural community. There were kids coming from all over the world, you know, because they're parents are either traveling internationally for work or they're ambassadors or, you know, things like this. I think that experience really taught me how to be open about cultural differences and how to really learn from each other, which is very similar to what New York is like. NYU was interesting because NYU doesn't have a campus, so like everything is spread out in the city. I think that definitely suits me better. You know, I grew up in Beijing. It has always been the metropolis kind of experience, and I like having the energy, the accessibility. So
yeah, the ambient noise in New York is very natural for you. And
yeah,
for
yeah,
the listeners who can hear the honking and cars driving by in the background, I mean, you're welcome. This is like coffee shop music in New York.
Totally. Yeah. Now I have to hear crazy people yelling on the street. And if it's too quiet, I get eared out.
So then when you attended NYU, you got a BFA, Bachelor of Fine Arts. Quickly, if you can, walk us through the journey of wanting to go pro in golf, which seems to be more of an athletic pursuit. I mean, I think there's like a certain refinement that we associate with golf, but still more athletic. And then you veer into the academic world of going to an IB program, and then you enter into the fine arts. So how did you make these kind of twists and turns and settle on getting your BFA?
I took IB higher level arts in high school. I had a very encouraging art teacher and pushed me to really develop my own process and my own thinking through art. I think it was probably through that experience I really wanted to study art. Photography is interesting because my department was called photography and imaging. So how imageries are viewed and perceived and how they're presented in. I think that really played in like an instrumental role in how I handle our marketing and branding today. For the RV program, was only about 30 kids a year. Statistically, only maybe one or two ended up being photographers. The rest of us became editors or some other like visual related.
Yeah. Can you share a little bit more about your process to branding and photography, editorial content for Chop Suey?
Okay. So let's say, for example, most of the people are going to view your products online. So when they're looking at a product, they're looking at the pictures of the product. And we're not just talking about like still images, because we're talking about like videos, animations, or primarily moving image. There are many, many ways to take a photograph of a thing, but there are only a few ways to maximize the properties that you wanna showcase. So there are a lot of communication that goes into picture editing, image editing. Like you have to be able to perceive that, you have to be able to analyze that, and like construct that with your other options and see if they tell a story in a more holistic way. You know, sometimes maybe a picture is not the best picture for this object, but together with other things, they look very strong and they tell different aspects of a story. Now, these days, a lot of visual goes into video production. Like people are, you know, sort of getting over stills and they want to see more moving image, which is really interesting on its own, because the videos provide much more realistic firsthand kind of experience, but it requires a lot more editing and pre-production. Right now we're producing a holiday campaign, so it's a lot of talks about, you know, which part we do still visuals and which part we do videos. I've been managing our Chop Suey Club's Instagram all these years. The stories are such an interesting thing. Is a unique channel. It's like, even though it's still on a social media, it comparatively is less formal than posting something in the feed. And then the story gives a lot more room to play with ideas and concept, and just like adding a lot more characters into our brand, which I'm guessing makes us stand out from other peer brands. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the ways in which your BFA in photography and image processing has paid off, the ROI is high.
That's my whole point. Yes.
I wonder too, at what point you were set on opening up a shop. Was it when you were getting your bachelor's, or was it when you were working at different galleries? At what point were you like, okay, I'm going to go off and start my own contemporary boutique?
I didn't have this idea until maybe 2 years after I graduated from college. I think while I was in college, I interned at many, many places. A lot of them are commercial photography places or magazines. I worked at WWD before, and I worked at Richard Avedon Foundation. I worked with I try to get myself into every kind of industry, as many industries as possible, just to see, to find out what I like and don't like. You know, maybe there are fields I don't even know exist, and you know, that could spike interest.
Side note, a lot of people say, like, with these industries, with the fine arts, with fashion and culture related brands, it's not so much what you know, it's who you know. But I imagine for you, as you were moving through these circles, you were intentional with making sure you were building up the who you knows. Is that fair to say? Or how did you manage to dip your toes into all of these highly sought after yet seemingly unattainable places?
I don't know what it is, but maybe I was lucky. That's actually one of the primary reasons I decided to stay in New York and open a store, because I didn't feel like that was an opportunity given to me anywhere. In the world, perhaps, definitely not in China. It wouldn't be as easy for me to do something like this in China. in America, what really strikes me about America is like, for someone like me who came from no connections or no relation to this country or the people here, I was given many opportunities. I was largely judged on my merits and my personality, you know, of who I am. They're not as much as like who you know. So that's what really
dispelling that myth.
Yeah. Let's say the
even for the fashion and the arts industries.
Even in the fashion and arts, WWD was like such a funny experience for me because I had no idea how big they were, how big they are. Until much later, like there was one night they asked me, say, "Hey, are you free? We need your help at this event." And I was like, "Okay." And they said, "Oh, you have to wear something slightly more formal, like a dress, you know, preferably dark, and blah blah blah." And your job would just be like running the cars for the photographer at the event. So they're gonna shoot a ton, and then you're gonna like, you know, come back and forth to load them. I was like, "Okay." And then it turned out to be the Met Gala. I didn't even know what it was. You know, I was just like, okay, what is this big event at the Metropolitan? And then just all of a sudden, all the celebrities start showing up in their gowns. And then I was running around. There's one point I got stuck, you know, on the red carpet because they're trying to run across to get the car from a photographer, and I had to like dodge under like Cate Blanchett because all the photographers were yelling at me to like get down.
What year did you attend the Met Gala?
I think it was 2015. There was still a picture of me and Beyonce's ass at some point. It was just like big picture of her and me. Like,
I'm going to ask you to share that link with me. I'm going to link it in the show notes. And also I'll look for like a stray black hair in Cate Blanchett's photo and be like, that's rubbing. 2015, we're on it.
It was hilarious. Yeah. And I think those were, I was lucky that I consider myself lucky that I didn't even know what these things were. I think that just gave me such a calm and normal mentality when I approach these things. It's definitely important that you know people, like your connections are definitely important. But I think more importantly, I see it these days is that how you really utilize your connections. The people you know don't have to be super important people at certain positions. You have to look at all of your resources and see how you can best utilize them, you know. That's what really helps me these days when we're producing any kind of content. I don't think I do know a lot of people, but I don't think I know them in such a way as like, oh, I know the secretary of blah blah blah, you know what I mean? So like I know all these Chinatown people, I know a lot of locals, I know people who do this and that. They all seem like so random, but when we actually need these connections, they're the best. They're real, genuine people, and we're able to find the best quality of them to put in this context to you. So I think that's more important. Yeah,
let's talk too about then your partnership with a lot of Chinatown's locals, because they do play a big part in the overall ecosystem of Chop Suey Club, right? And I'm curious if that was intentional, if you knew that you wanted to partner with the heart and soul of Chinatown, given that you guys are in between the Lower East Side and Chinatown, and just how that form of business ownership has influenced your form. Because Chinatown, we understand to be like great deals made in China, understood in one lens. And then for Chop Suey Club, you guys are redefining what made in China means, while still paying homage to kind of the forefathers and the founding mothers of a businesswoman or man who's Chinese looks like and what they do and what they sell. So anyway, that was a long-winded way of asking in what ways you've parlayed the foundation that Chinatown has laid into building and running Chop Suey, and in what ways you are adding to that tradition.
It's definitely a conscious strategic decision to involve Chinatown, to incorporate Chinatown heavily into our marketing or branding or just general activities. How I view Chinatown is that the Chinatown is not anybody's China, basically. It's not a real reflection of any part of China, not Hong Kong, not Beijing, not Shanghai. They are unique beings. They're like Chinese or Asian or just general immigrants. So even for a Chinese person, Chinatown is still like a destination or like a little amusement park. You know, you find a lot of Chinese elements from different regions and different areas. Some of them are grown here, came from Chinese Americans, you know. That's also partially why I decided to call it Chop Suey Club, because chop suey is the first Chinese American dish invented largely to cater to the American palates, because, you know, you have to simplify the ingredients and like tone down the spices and flavors.
Yeah, it's a gateway dish.
Yeah, it's a gateway dish. So chop suey was like a simple entry point to Chinese food. And I do like that conversation between Chinese culture and Chinese immigrant culture. At the beginning, I felt like because the store, we're not backed by any large finance group. I'm just doing it myself with certain savings and foundings I gathered. With a very modest founding, I have to do it very strategically, and our products can be easily carried by any other brand who wants to do the same thing. But what really would make us stand out is our unique position and our relation to this area. And for me, I feel like one is to encourage people to really come to this area to explore. I feel like a lot of the Chinese businesses, particularly older ones, they're not very conscious about marketing or PR. And for me, I feel like, okay, if they don't know how to do this, then we're gonna do some for them. And it's also a way for us to promote ourselves. Being a Chinese person living in this area, I get asked all the time. You know, we get asked constantly where to go get dumplings, where to, you know, to go do things or see things, or even like find a tailor, that kind of stuff. We do have answers for all of those. So I feel like, okay, maybe it's much easier for us to just make a map so people don't have to ask us all the time, and this thing can be updated, and we can start building a community or like a more conscious cross promotion. Like last year's map was the first time we started doing a I guess more serious collaboration where you can get deals at certain shops, and then once you redeem the deal, you get a stamp, and then once you collected all the stamps, you can get a mystery box from us. So that's another way to bring people back to our store and really feel that they're gaining something more unique. I want it to be very experience focused. I'm just gonna divulge a little into the Chinatown matter, because it's a big issue. Chinatown is mostly reliant on the real estate being stable and family owned. That's why it stayed for so long. So unlike the Little Italy, which is right above Chinatown, Little Italy, now if you go there, all local New Yorkers know that it's a touristy place. But everything seems like it was just set up to cater to the tourists. No real New Yorkers really go there, you know what I mean? So, and that is partially because a lot of the first and second generation Italian property owners, they decided to sell. And then so, you know, and that's how it became what it is today. But unlike Little Italy, Chinatown, Chinese people don't want to sell. Chinese people don't like to sell their properties. And what makes it even more difficult to sell was that a lot of buildings were owned by family associations. So it's like a bunch of people own the same building. You know, to get everybody on board to sell this thing, it would be like so difficult to do. So that's kind of how Chinatown stayed around for so long. Basically, right now, it comes down to the second generation or third generation owners to decide what they want to do. You know, a lot of them don't want to rent young Asian Americans, they don't want to run business. They don't want to, they're not interested in that regard. So some of them, of course, would sell. But then you also have a huge group of like very passionate young Asian kids who inherited their parents' property and they want to do something for the area. The truth is, once Chinatown goes away, it would never come back again. So it is really, really important, at least in my eyes, to preserve what we have now. Representation is huge, and over the years I realized that more and more we are more conscious about using Asian models, showing Asian characters or personalities under our brand or whatever content we're trying to push, because you definitely need these people and personality to show younger generation Asian kids that, you know, you can be the same and do the same. The bamboo ceiling shouldn't stop you. You know, your Asianness shouldn't be an obstacle for you to move anywhere. And in fact, you should be very proud because it makes you stand out.
Yeah, how it can be a personal and professional strength. Because so often it's like an obstacle that you have to get over. It's like, oh, well, this is a part of your identity. However, make sure, you know, you smooth it over and become more like something else. When rather we should be talking about, this is not an obstacle, it's fuel. And I'm curious for you if you have any specific instances in which you realized that your heritage is actually propulsion.
I'll say the entire Chop Suey Club is my biggest realization of how we can use this perceived disadvantage to be our biggest advantage. My big advantage as an immigrant is that I'm not from this culture. I probably don't embody or understand the entire American culture very well, my local culture. But what other people don't have is my knowledge of Chinese culture. As normal and ordinary as my knowledge is, there's still so much a person, American person, doesn't know. There are a lot of talks about cultural appropriations and like how people are generally outraged by, let's say, a white person trying to wear a qipao dress or trying to, you know, create something that has a lot of the Asian elements. I think there's a difference between cultural appropriation and cultural appreciation. I think it's easy to tell. And if a person just wants to wear it or even want to like explore this kind of aesthetics and motifs and ideas, I don't see why not. If we're doing it really well and we're being very strong about it, we're supposed to give other people opportunities to learn about these things too. If we do it better, we do it better because we do have more in-depth understanding of it.
I love what you say, like the distinction between appropriation and appreciation. And it sounds like Chop Suey Club is really doubling down on the latter. And maybe for those people who walk through the doors being like, oh, this teapot looks interesting, I want to wear it to Coachella, but I know nothing about Chinese culture. You're like, okay, well, this is a gateway and I'm going to take it as an opportunity to provide you the context so that you can appreciate it and switch from appropriating this culture to appreciating it. So beyond pushing product at Chop Suey Club, you have such a intangible value that you are adding to the community and adding to this cultural conversation that's happening in Chinatown. And I wonder if as you are growing your store, growing your brand, anything unexpected that's crossed your path.
Okay, so we have this section in our store, we call it Dollar Store. It's basically a mini curated collection of novelties found in Chinatown. A lot of them you can find in our local Chinatowns. We tell people that we found these things in Chinatown, and if they want to find it themselves, they're more than welcome to go find them. That's kind of the idea. Surprisingly, most people would still want to buy from us with a higher price tag, of course, and they're aware of these things. They're still willing to pay us. I think it's mostly because they appreciate the curation. I think that has been a pretty surprising thing. Even with us telling people where you can find these things, people are still wanting to support us. I think what surprised me the most was over the years how much love and support we received. I came from, you know, our art background today. I didn't have a day of retail experience, to be honest. I just sort of started it as an experiment almost, when just trying to see how far we can go with this idea. While I was buying some new clothes for myself, I was trying to see if I can find some contemporary, you know, Chinese designer brands to have. And it was just incredibly difficult to even find information about them. That was 4 or 5 years ago. And so I started thinking, okay, that's really interesting. Like, there's almost no presence. And I think it's because we're able to function at such a small scale, like to maintain this boutique operation and branding, we're able to survive for this long and really cut through. It's just because there is a much more distinct personality. There is a much faster turnaround time. There's not that many decision-making, you know, levels that have to go through where everybody has to agree on this or that.
Unlike selling a home in Chinatown.
Yeah. And I just know that as there are gonna be more people like me, like say Chinese people living abroad, and like Chinese Americans, you know, start building their homes and this and that, they're gonna want more things that represents them and their culture. And I guess that's what I saw at the time. And now after these years, it really shows that there has been a significant growth in Chinese design locally and overseas, and there is a much more demand for these type of things.
So there's the growing potential audience base, and then you're also confronted with the growing number of active cases of COVID. How has it been navigating owning a brick and mortar?
I think for me, the biggest lesson learned, probably two. One is that we really, really should have worked more on our e-commerce before the store. It was a very conscious choice to open this store when I first opened it. I didn't plan on opening a physical store so soon. The lease basically fell in my hand. It's either I take it or we, you know, leave that location completely. That's when I took a big gamble, and it certainly was paying off, but it definitely occupied a lot of our time. So for a while, I guess I was very distracted by the whole store operations. I didn't really put the required thoughts into e-commerce. Also, given that some of our stuff, we only got very small quantities. By the time we put all the visuals and stuff online, it's already sold out. So that's why I didn't really do much of that. But for a while, I was really relying on the store sales. But then when the pandemic hits, for maybe a couple of months, I was kind of struggling with we're suffering a huge loss of in-store sales, and we're just really trying to catch up with the online sales. It was very painful. But now, you know, if you know what the problem is, you tackle it, and then it will improve. So we're seeing big improvement these days. And we having trouble like reopening our store because it's still under renovation, and we keep discovering more and more things about this physical store that we have to fix. So I was really annoyed and bothered by how we can reopen our store. But then it turned out we have to do outdoor sales. We have to pull a lot of our merchandise outdoor for weekend sales, just because we can't let people inside yet. And then we didn't really know what was gonna happen or like how well it would do, but we did it anyhow. And it's just been more and more successful. Like, a lot of people want to join us to, you know, to sell, and like, we actually exposed our stuff to more people, because then everyone who walks on the street is your potential customer. A lot of people who never came into our store before, or like they were intimidated by how it looked, like now they know what's inside, which is another sort of a surprise. I think all in all, it's really the concept that, you know, the yin and yang are two sides of the same thing. When the yin becomes really strong, it will turn into a yang. When the yang becomes too strong, it will turn into a yin. So the idea is like, there is no inherent good or bad. It's just like, how do you see it and how do you work with these elements and forces, you know? So I feel like now I have a much calmer mentality, you know, when I face similar uncertainties and unpredictable factors. We're really trying to see it from like a more positive side, you know, really how to use this, the characteristics of this factor to your advantage. Just do your best with what you're given, you know.
I think this is a good segue then to the final question, which is, what's one motto that you're taking with you? One like North Star that you see guiding you for the next 12 months?
I would say don't panic, you know, don't panic over your plans not going as you plan. My father gave me a book from a war strategist. He was a teacher of the Persian prince. He said the thing that really determines whether you win or not is not really how much force you have, how much military force or supplies or backings you have. It's more about how determined the leader is, because he says when the war starts, everything you plan will fall apart. Almost immediately, they will fall apart. So knowing very clear where you want to go, just move towards that goal. It doesn't have to be a straight line or a 1, 2, 3 like you planned. Be flexible in between, but just be very clear with where you want to be.
Totally. To expect the unexpected and to surf the waves. I mean, your story too, just starting thinking that you wanted to pursue a professional golf career to now being founder and director of Chop Suey Club. I mean, if that isn't a textbook representation of expect the unexpected and just keep it moving, I mean, I don't know what is. As a customer of Chop Suey Club too, I'm just so glad that the golf career puttered out and you weren't interested in that anymore, because I think the New York shopping ecosystem is better thanks to Chop Suey Club.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for your wise words, Royi, and for sharing your story with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really happy we got to talk about this.
And that is a wrap. Thank you, listener, for tuning in. If you liked what you heard, drop a review on Apple Podcast. And if you are hungry for more hot and sour soup, check us out at www.thebaybrigade.com. There is plenty more multi-sensory goodness awaiting you there. Until next time, goodbye. Zaijian. Toodaloo.